Today's Teisho will be on case 37 in the Book of Serenity. Case 37 is entitled Guishan's Active Consciousness. Introduction. Driving away the plowman's ox, pulling its nose around, taking away the hungry man's food, holding his throat tight. Is there anyone who can administer the poison? Case. Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said all sentient beings just have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I will call him, hey you. If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, I say, not only is their active consciousness boundless and clear, they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. Verse, one call and he turns his head. Do you know the self or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that. The child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destination, has such sorrow. Thank you for coming to practice Zen this morning. Some of you are here for the first time, and I'd like to explain that what I have just read is called a koan. And in our tradition, people learn how to focus attention by watching the breath. And if you focus attention by watching the breath long enough, you undergo a change of consciousness. You enter what you could call an altered state of awareness. And in that altered state of awareness, you are more open to the world around you. And in that condition, you are receptive in a way that you might not ordinarily be in your everyday distracted life. And in our tradition of training, when you're in that very open and receptive state, the teacher will give you, or may give you, what is called a koan. And koans take the form of a story usually involving famous figures from Buddhism or from Zen in the past. Sometimes they describe moments when somebody had a breakthrough experience and encountered a deeper level of enlightened mind, you could say. Now, you know, the truth is that if you read books on Zen practice, you will often see quotations from these koans. And sometimes, they make sense intellectually. You know, sometimes they have a clear message and a clear meaning. And sometimes when people write books on Zen, they use passages from the koans to illustrate a point. But actually, these koans are usually or properly used in a different way. You have to be in a state of concentration and openness. And then when the teacher gives it to you, the koans operate as a subliminal cue. A subliminal cue, something that's going to operate on a deeper level, on an unconscious level, and open you up even more fully to the world. So, you know, the language of the koans is a strange language. It's not everyday language. It has a puzzling quality and somewhat dreamlike quality. I think that the closest thing in our Western tradition to koans actually is might be myths, you know, like Greek myths or fairy tales, you know, fairy tales. So when Little Red Riding Hood goes to find her grandmother, goes to see her grandmother, and her grandmother has been eaten by a wolf, and she walks into the room, and her grandmother her grandmother's clothes are now being worn by the wolf. You know, in an ordinary everyday consciousness, you would say, "Oh my God, my grandmother has been eaten by a wolf." But in the fairy tale, she can't detect that a wolf is now dressed in her grandmother's clothing. So she enters the room, and the wolf is in the bed with the grandmother's bonnet on and the grandmother's robe, and the covers are pulled up. And the Little Red Riding Hood is unable to understand, for some reason, that her grandmother has been eaten by this animal. And so she asks a series of questions, you know. She says, "Grandmother, what big eyes you have, you know. And the better to see you with, my dear." And then, "Grandmother, what a big nose you have, you know." So, I mean, when we read a fairy tale like that, we're no longer operating in everyday consciousness, you know. The story is asking us to enter a different kind of consciousness. And it's a consciousness that's much closer to the mind of like a child, or to the mind that we occupy when we're in a state of dream, or when we're between dream and waking. And fairy tales are very much like this, right? I mean, there's something elemental and very deep about the Little Red Riding Hood story, right? A little girl is going to find her grandmother, but her grandmother has been eaten by a wolf. You know, and the wolf is a complex figure, right? You know, if you say, "What does the wolf mean?" You know, it's very complicated. You'd have to let yourself associate for a while, right? You know, wolves are wild beasts. They live in the forest. They represent our animal nature. They represent our body nature. They're untamed. They're not civilized. Wolves are raw appetite. Wolves are violence. You know, all of these things are embodied in the character of a wolf. If you really want to process the story of Little Red Riding Hood on a deep level, you probably have to sit with it for a while and let it percolate in your mind. You know, actually, the story of Little Red Riding Hood could actually be a koan, you know, could actually be a koan. I haven't given it to anybody. I haven't said, "Little Red Riding Hood meets the wolf. Go meditate on that," you know. But I could, you know, I could. And you'd sit with this. And you could try to figure it out. You could say, "Well, what does a wolf represent?" Right? What does a wolf represent? And you could try to figure it out intellectually. But a deeper engagement with the story would require you to sit with it. And it would drop down into your mind like a stone thrown into a well. You know, and it would begin to trigger all of these feelings, perhaps, and associations. You know, when my brother was a little boy, he used to love to go out in the woods with his dog. And I don't think my brother was really happy unless he was out in the woods with his dog. And I don't know if you've ever had a dog, but dogs are really wonderful animals, you know. They have very little of their... First of all, dogs are very loving. You know, they're very loving. And dogs also don't seem to have our sense of self-doubt, you know. So dogs are much more spontaneous than we are. I think they are able to be in the moment more fully without so many, you could say, neurotic, excuse me, so many neurotic hesitations. So, you know, my brother would go out in the woods with his dog, and the dog would sort of lead the way. And you know how dogs are. You know, the dog would see something that excited him, and he'd run off. Then my brother would have to call him, and he'd come back. And then, you know, the dog would be walking along, and he'd smell something, and start sniffing, 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 sniffing. And, you know, sometimes the dog would see a pond, and our dog, his name was actually Sergeant. Sergeant would see a pond, and, you know, the way dogs drink water sometimes is not to lean over into the pond. They wade right into the pond. They go all the way into the pond so that the water is up to their mouth, and then they sort of open their mouth and slurp. You know, it's really delightful, right? Who would have thought, you know? We'd lean over and cup the water and bring it up to our lips. But a dog will just go into the water fully and then drink, you know, drink from that position of being surrounded by water. So I wonder, maybe water tastes better if you are actually immersed in it up to your mouth. You know, you can really taste the water if you're in it, you know. So somehow I think dogs enjoy that, you know. And dogs enjoy the smells, you know. When my brother would go out in the woods with the dog, I think he would feel liberated by the presence of the dog. Because the dog was, you know, unselfconscious and in its enjoyment of the world around it. In a way, my brother, even as a little kid, couldn't quite be, because he was a human being. You know, so the dog for my brother was a kind of a teacher, kind of teacher figure. The dog allowed my brother to experience the natural world in a way that my brother, with his self-consciousness, couldn't. And I think one of the reasons my brother loved the dog so much was that the dog had this quality of teaching him how to, or helping him to experience the world more fully. And maybe this is why we like our pets, you know. Because we ourselves are a little bit locked up in our self-consciousness, all these rules, you know, and dogs don't have so many rules, you know. So our dog would just, when he saw a deer, he'd chase the deer until he got tired, and my brother would call and call, and the dog would come back so happy, right, so happy to chase the deer. And you know, the dog would see water, and it would just wade into the pond. Our dog sometimes would, I'm sure if you have a dog, you know that they'll do this. If they find a dead animal, they'll roll in it. And it was such delight, right? You know, it's just, for them it must be like perfume, like incense, right? It's like, oh, what a fascinating smell, and I'll take it with me. And then they roll, you know. Well, dogs just have this, or our dog had this incredible spontaneity and naturalness, you know. And so, dogs are a little bit like wolves. You know, if you sit with the Little Red Riding Hood koan, you know, after a while you're going to be able to maybe remember something about your dog, you know, that was spontaneous and free like this, you know. Your animal nature that we are so ashamed of, right? There's other elements, though, to animal nature, too, you know, like... You know, a wolf is also a predator. You know, wolves are dangerous. And wolves are sexual. You know, so wolves have all these characteristics that are both liberating and maybe make us nervous, make us frightened, right? It might be hard for us to come to terms with the wolf inside of us. You know, and yet the fairy story, the fairy tale, is really saying that Little Red Riding Hood has to come to terms with the wolf somehow, right? So you know, this is all operating on a subliminal level. You know, the story has so much resonance, not on a conscious level, but on this deeper level. the wolf. You know, even if we've never seen a wolf, we kind of know what that wolf is about. So koans in Zen operate in the same way. They're like the language of fairy tales. They're speaking to us on a deeper level than the ordinary narrative. And in order to be really effectively engaged with the koan, we need to be able to enter a state of samadhi. So when, you know, normally, we have a lot of constrictions, a lot of barriers, you know. In everyday consciousness, we're monitoring ourselves very carefully, and we are often a little bit rigid, a little bit stiff, and a little bit unnatural. Not always, but often. And also, everyday consciousness is a little bit neurotic. You know, it is a consciousness that is very much, it feels a little bit separate from everything around it, you know. The everyday consciousness is more or less a kind of very self-centered consciousness. And it's also very like, it has a purpose, you know, it's getting things done. You have a means and you're trying to get to some kind of, achieve some kind of a purpose. This is like everyday consciousness. So when I go into my office, I have to answer emails. First thing I do, unfortunately, is have to answer all these emails. You know, and I have to sort of work through the emails and so on. And this is everyday consciousness, you know. You might be plugging through your emails, and then you might want to take a break, and you might Google Cancun Beach, right? And then a picture comes up of the beach in Cancun, Mexico, and you could visualize yourself walking along the beach. Now you've sort of stepped out of that everyday consciousness. And the ordinary consciousness has this quality of being like very self-conscious, very self-centered, and it's a little bit rigid and a little bit nervous, if I may say so. You know, it's a little bit nervous. We're always a little bit worried about how other people will see us, you know, and that means we feel a little bit disconnected from other people. So, you know, when I'm working in my office, sometimes I really will take a break from my work, and I will do something like surf the web, and I'll look for beaches, you know, cool beach. My wife and I went to Kauai about 5 years ago, and the other day I was surfing the web looking at the place where we stayed on the beach in Kauai, and my assistant knocked on my door, my secretary knocked on my door and came in, and I'm at my computer and there's this picture of the beach on Kauai, and she's been working very hard, and I felt a little embarrassed, like, you know, you're out there in the other room working really hard, and I'm in here surfing the web looking at pictures of beaches, you know. So, she, you know, I could see her thinking, oh, so that's what he really does in his office, right, you know. And I actually just clicked it off, right, and went back to my document, you know, to show, look, I was just taking a break. I'm really working very hard in here, you know. See, this is ordinary consciousness, you know. So in that state, you can't be too receptive. You're not that receptive. You know, you're nervous. You're worried, a little bit. When you come in and you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath. You know, little by little, you'll enter a state that's not like that or that consciousness. It's not that means ends, very purposive, very self-conscious mind. You know, you begin to watch the breath, and it's sort of opening you up. It's opening you up. Everybody is sitting on the cushion, their eyes are closed or half open. Nobody's looking at anybody else. We don't have to worry about how we appear because the room is dark, you know. And we're sort of focused on the breath, and the breath is pulling us out into the world. It's taking us out. And after a while, we're more relaxed. You know, breathing deeply from the abdomen relaxes you. The breath takes us out, so we begin to feel more connected, you know, begin to feel more connected. And we're in a different psychological place. Right? We're much more receptive. It's more like that state of where, you know sometimes between waking and sleeping, you know, you're in this state, you know. There's a state. It's not quite between waking and sleeping, but it's definitely an altered state of consciousness. And we call that samadhi. When you're in samadhi, you know, things are very different. You know, so at the end of a sit, at the end of the evening, when we do our meditation, if you have a cup of tea, you'll notice that the tea is really delicious. You know, it's really, oh my God, this tea. You know, or the date. You know, it's just one little date, but you eat it, and it's like the sweetest thing in the universe. This is because you're in samadhi. You're in samadhi. If you were busy at your computer and you're working and you had a date, you might not even notice the taste. You know, you might have some tea. I myself drink tea all day long, and at first it's delicious, but after about the fourth cup, you know, I'm just washing it down. You know, and I'm at my computer and I'm not paying attention. It's not that good. But at the end of the evening, if I have a cup of tea, it's just like, oh my God, is that good? You know, tea. So when you're in that state and you're given a koan, it has a kind of, you could say, psychoactive quality, right? It's like throwing a rock into a well, and it begins to, at first it doesn't seem to mean anything, or you might try to figure it out intellectually, but when you sit with it for a while, it begins to produce results. It begins to produce like an inner processing. And usually, you know, koans help us to encounter some kind of a barrier in ourselves, that we usually aren't aware of because we spend so much time. We spend so much time in our small conscious, that, you know, at the very shallowest level of awareness, which is self-conscious, instrumental thinking, you know. And we only encounter our barriers periodically or sporadically, you know. I mentioned that a friend of mine has a phobia when he tries to drive over the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. He used to like to vacation in Chincoteague. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's in Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia on this peninsula. And there's these wild horses. They're very beautiful, and they live out in the swamps. And people go out there to vacation. And there's parks out there. In the summer, you have to have really good bug repellent, though, or you'll be eaten alive. He used to take his family to Chincoteague for the summer, and after his mother died, he was driving across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, and he began to tremble uncontrollably. And it became so acute that he had to stop the car, and his wife had to take over. And since then, he's had a lot of problems driving over bridges. He pretty much has to have somebody else if the bridges are too long. The phobia just gets the better of him. Now, you know, in a case like this, we can actually see our barrier. You know, we might not want to deal with it, but it becomes visible to us. But usually they're not visible to us. You know, our barriers are invisible, and we never allow ourselves to see them. So, you know, my mother was a very shy person. And a lot of times she would try to avoid being in situations where she had to interact with people, especially as she got older. And this wasn't really good for her at all. You know, it's like the more you try to avoid interacting with people, the more introverted you get. And pretty soon just going to the grocery store is an emotionally challenging experience. You know, so the best thing for my mother would have been to actually like be in a book club or really have to deal with people, even though it was difficult, you know, it would have been good for her. She would have had to, you know, really get out there and be with people, and it would have made her uncomfortable, but she would have gotten through it, right? And then would have been glad to have friends, you know. But instead, especially as she got older, she became more and more reclusive, you know, and this really made it things worse. Well, you know, she never really saw this aspect of herself, you know. She was just trying to sidestep pain or discomfort, but it wound up making her world smaller and smaller. And we all have things like this, you know, but we can't see them. And you might think, well, what does this have to do with enlightenment? You know, what does it have to do with... But you know, enlightenment is really a state of openness or receptivity. You know, the human being gets closed up more and more and more and more if we're not careful. You know, some people lead really creative lives. You know, they're able to work around their problems, their barriers, and they keep opening up. And that's a successful life. You know, when you find these barriers in yourself, if you do encounter them, you work through them, and then you're able to live more fully. Well, Zen practice is really like that too, you know. We do a lot of Zazen, and we're not just becoming relaxed. You know, the early stages of meditation are about becoming relaxed. And that's so we can open up. You can't open up if you're too tense. You know, so the first, say, 10 or 15 minutes of every meditation is really just like entering deep relaxation. And that itself is really therapeutic. It's really good for you. But you know, 15 minutes of meditation is really actually not meditation. It's just relaxation. So if you meditate half an hour a day, you're really meditating about 10 minutes a day. I'm not putting it down. The relaxation is really important. You need to, you know, please keep sitting. But it takes about 15 minutes just to enter, have a relaxation response. And then you're more open. And then, you know, you'll be more aware of what's going on. You know, you'll be more conscious of what's going on in your awareness, your field of awareness. So, you know, if you come in to sit down on the cushion at the end of the day, you might not know why you're tense. You might just be tense. And you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, and after about 15 minutes, you suddenly might remember that something at work upset you, right? You weren't even able to remember that earlier because you were just so tense. So the deep relaxation kicks in, and suddenly you realize, oh, you realize you're replaying this event in your head over and over again. So if you keep sitting, you know, eventually you stop replaying that and you feel better. You know, basically initial stage of Zen practice is learning how to just relax. And then, you know, we enter sort of this alternate consciousness, and we work through some of the things that happen during the day that are potentially going to be barriers. And then if we keep sitting, we work on our deeper barriers. And if you think about it, as this is happening, your awareness is becoming more and more dispersed or extensive. You know, normally our circle of awareness is very narrow, very circumscribed, very small. This is like everyday life, you know. I've got to get to work. You know, that meeting is at 9:30. I'm going to be late, you know. And, you know, you're driving down the road and, you know, maybe somebody's in your way and you're pissed off, you know, and you get to work and you know, you're very, very narrowly focused. You might get into the meeting and somebody says, oh, that's a nice tie, you know, and you might think, you know, what does he mean by that, you know, and so this is like ordinary awareness, right? It's very narrow, very small. It's like, I need to do what I need to do. It's about me. You know, and this is just human nature. You know, our ordinary consciousness is very self-centered. It's very purposive. You know, it's like get to the point, get to the end, get to the goal, and so it's very circumscribed. And there's a lot of fear and anxiety in that mental space. You know, but if you relax, you begin to open up. It's like your circle of awareness gets a little bigger. And then, you know, if you meditate, you enter samadhi, it gets a little bigger, you know, a little bigger. Now, you know, one of the things we do is called sesshin, these meditation retreats. We're going to have a sesshin on Tuesday night, and we're going to meditate many hours a day. And if you do this, your mind is going to, your awareness, your field of awareness is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and also deeper and deeper and deeper. And by that I mean that the barrier between your conscious mind and your unconscious is going to become more porous. So your field of awareness is going to get bigger, and the depth of your awareness is going to become different as well. You know, normally there's a fairly rigid wall between what's conscious and unconscious, right? And there's a kind of policing, you know, keeping that wall closed, right? You know, there's all kinds of reasons we have to do that. You know, we have to sort of keep that door very closed. You know, so, I mean, suppose somebody makes me nervous or makes me angry. I really can't show it, you know. Sometimes a student will try to piss me off, you know, and I have to appear to be neutral and even-minded. I can't let those emotions out too much, you know. And maybe I can't even look at them. But when I'm at Sesshin, you know, I can be a little bit more exploratory. I can be a little bit more open. And maybe I have anger that I have to deal with that I haven't allowed myself to see, and it might come out during the Sesshin. So basically, you know, meditation is about expanding our awareness and to the point where we begin to realize that we are not exactly what we thought we were. You know? Normally, you know, we would say, I'm me, and the world is out there. This is like ordinary consciousness. We think of ourselves as permanent entities like chairs, you know, or cars, or something like that. But actually, the human is not like that at all, really. I mean, the Zen view is that would be quite mistaken. You know, when I go up in the mountains here in New Jersey, I like to walk along streams. And sometimes you'll notice that, like, the water's coming down the stream, and there's a rock that's obstructing the flow of the water. And the water begins to flow in a circle, like a concentric circle, like a little whirlpool, we would say, you know. From the Zen view, the Buddhist view, the human being is like a whirlpool, right? It's like this, or like a little whirlpool, or like a little whirlwind, like a whirlwind, you know. We are really a dynamic system, you know. If you say where's Kurt? Is Kurt his feet? You know, is Kurt his hearing? Is Kurt, you know, Kurt is all of these things and really none of them, you know. The human being is like a dynamic system. A human being is like a forest. A human being is like weather, you know, actually. And the problem is, though, that, you know, the fact that we are changing all the time, and that we don't have any essential core. There's nothing in the whirlpool. It's just water, you know. It's just water, you know. If a whirlpool, could think, it would think, you know. At first, it would think, oh, this is so fun, you know. This is so fun, you know. But then, at some point, it would go, but wait. Wait, you know, what happens if you move the rock? You know, it begins to get worried and panicky. You know, so basically, humans are really the dynamic system, and meditation is all because it's frightening to be a dynamic system. It's so open, and we're so changeable. It can be a little frightening. You know, I was just reading this psychologist named Daniel Gilbert, and he was saying people are terrible at predicting what they're going to want in 10 years. So basically, when people imagine like their retirement, they think, oh, it would be so nice to be on a beach, you know, I remember going to Kauai. It would be so nice to just live in a little hut on the beach, you know, and so on. And he said, actually, you know, when you're 10 years down the road, that won't be your dream at all. You'll have a totally different desire, you know. He said, people are constantly changing, and when they think of the future, they imagine that 10 years from now they're going to be the person they are now. I think that's very astute. You know, we're constantly changing, and we're very, actually very open to circumstances. And this can be a little terrifying. And so, you know, when things hurt us, we close up, we constrict, and our field of awareness gets very narrow. But meditation, you could say, Zen is all about embracing the potential for openness, you know? And so it's developing enough trust to be more open and to be like a fully dynamic system, you know? And when we're in this open, dynamic state, you know, we're actually very happy, very excited, you know? It's just a little frightening sometimes. It's a little frightening to be so open, yeah? And generally speaking, things that have hurt us have caused us to become vigilant and closed up. But if you have done meditation and you find it refreshing, it's because you enjoy that openness. You enjoy that openness. And let's face it, Zen is very safe, you know? You come into a room like this, it's nobody's going to hurt you, there's no risks. You sit on the cushion, you watch your breath. Not much can go wrong, right? So you're learning how to be open like in a controlled environment. You know, if you come to Sesshin, and I highly recommend it, it's one of the most wonderful experiences in the world. You know, there's a schedule and everything is taken care of for you. You know, food will be provided, you know, there's really no sources of stress, actually. And you can be very open in a controlled environment. And the idea is that when you leave the Sesshin or when you leave here, you'll be out in your everyday life where it's a little bit more difficult to be so open, but you'll still be more open than you normally are. See, that's the idea. And little by little, you know, people become more comfortable with their fundamental nature as a dynamic system, you know, not something that's permanent and fixed, but something that's constantly in motion and constantly, you know, we are everything around us. And that boundary between ourselves and the world is not at all fixed. You know, we when we get frightened, we draw a very clear line between what is us and what is not us. But that's really a fiction designed to protect us from fear. And we all do it. I do it too, you know. But when we're at our best, when we're at our most open, you know, we feel very connected. When you meditate sometimes and you have tea in the evening, it's just so good. You know, if at Sesshin, you know, we sit out, we can hear the birds singing or the wind blowing, and it's just so wonderful to hear the birds singing or the wind blowing, see. It's just really wonderful when you're in that open state. Everything, you experience the other as the self, and it's very, you have a real, it's really a rush, you know. It's really, there's a very powerful sense of elation. I think humans crave that openness, and they crave that connectedness, you know. We're torn by, you know, we crave it and we're afraid. This is like our dilemma, right? You know, we have two basic impulses. You know, it's like centrifugal and centripetal. One is pulling us inward, right? But there's this other one that's taking us outward. And there's always a little tension between these two things. But I myself like to do things, besides Zazen, I like to do things like hiking, because you know I can relax, I'm not going to get hurt, and I op feel open up, you know. And many things make us feel more open. For some people, it's music. You know, my second teacher was a really wonderful musician, and he would just sit down at the piano and play for hours. And he felt so open when he could do that, you know. So he was able to use the openness on the cushion to do all kinds of other wonderful things. So, you know, if somebody asks you what a human being is, you can say it's a whirlwind. You know, it's really a wonderful thing to be a whirlwind. Many years ago, I was backpacking in the Southwest. My friend from college, Larry, and I went backpacking. And we didn't have any money. We didn't have much money. So we got out of college, and we both saved, I think it was about $500, which is not nothing, but that was all the money we had in the world. And we had some traveler's checks, and we had our checkbooks and our backpacks, and we hitchhiked across the country. And we were backpacking in the Southwest, and we were in Colorado. And we were hitchhiking by the side of the road, and we were standing there by the side of the road, and all of a sudden, the wind started forming right, I swear this is true, started forming right in front of us, this whirlwind. And the whirlwind picked up this piece of paper, and it just carried it all the way up into the sky until it disappeared from view. And I've never forgotten that. I thought that was the most amazing thing, you know. But, you know, life is kind of like that, right? You know, life is so, we ourselves are sort of like that, you know. But we're afraid of our own openness. I guess that's how to put it. But fundamentally, you know, we are this dynamic system. We're fundamentally connected. Fundamentally, we're alive. This life energy surging through us. You know, that's what we are. My brother, you know, by the time he was about 11 years old, was already getting a little bit closed up. This is sort of, you know, you probably remember becoming a teenager, you know. When you were a little kid, over Thanksgiving, I went down to see my sister. My sister is 7 years younger than I am, so she's now 50. And she had her kids when she was in her 40s. She was very late. She was one of these people who waited and right to the last minute to have kids. And so she has a child who's 10 and a child who's 8. And they aren't yet teenagers, you know. And so, you know, when especially the younger one, you know, when he comes out of his room in the morning, you know, he's got on like this, you know, pajama top, and you know, his underwear sticking out. He doesn't care yet, you know, and his hair's all messed up. He's really just interested in what's going on, you know. When he becomes a teenager, none of this is going to be possible, right? He's going to start looking at himself in the mirror and going, "Oh my God, my nose, it's too big, you know, or my head, it's too something, you know, I'm too fat, I'm too thin, you know." And he'll have to start buying the right shirts. He'll have to have a certain kind of toy, right? You know, or a certain kind of, he'll have to have an iPod. He'll have to have the right music on his iPod. You know, we all go through this, right? You know, I can remember being mortified. My mother bought me this shirt, I remember. And when I saw it, I just thought, "Oh my God, you know, I can't wear this shirt to school." And, you know, my mother had grown up in the Depression. She had been very poor. It was like, "What, are you crazy? You know, I just bought you a shirt. You're going to wear that shirt, young man." And I remember waiting for the school bus and just thinking, "Oh my God, when my friends see me in this, you know." If I could have thrown myself over a cliff right then, I probably would have done it, you know. And really, if I could have just called down a rock on my head, you know, just... I would have probably said, "Okay, kill me now," rather than undergo the humiliation I was about to endure because of my shirt, right? This is a teenage life, right? So my brother was sort of edging his way into teenage life, and he would run out in the forest with his dog, and the dog would roll in the dead fish and, you know, go into the water up to his mouth, and my brother would be reminded of what we ourselves really are, you know. We have this great potential for freedom. And, my dog, Sergeant, our dog was so happy, you know. He had real joie de vivre, as they say. He really loved to drink water, you know. He really loved to eat food. And he didn't worry too much about how it looked, right, you know. But, you know, by the time you're 14 years old, you know, it's all got to be acceptable to everybody else. And it doesn't stop, right? It doesn't stop. You know, the teenage years are left behind, but, you know, those kinds of constraints are still there in many ways. So living life skillfully means being able to live in that world of adults, right? But also have this openness. And that's difficult. That's a hard task. But Zen can help, right? I was talking to somebody last night who isn't here today, but he's coming to the Sesshin. And he said, you know, I go through my job, I have all these things going on, and I don't always make time for sitting, he said, but then I go to Sesshin, and by about day three of Sesshin, I realize, oh my gosh, life could be like this. Life can be like this. Then he said, I get back in my life, and I sort of forget it again, you know. This is very understandable, you know. But every once in a while, we sit down on the cushion, or we practice Zen for half a day on a Saturday, or we do Sesshin, and we realize just how open we can get, how amazingly open we humans can get. And, you know, really, these really dynamic systems. So, Guishan's active consciousness is this open mind that's taking in everything, right? It recognizes everything it encounters, it experiences as part of itself, as part of its field of awareness. Yeah. So I'm going to read it again, and you'll notice when I read it again that this doesn't quite make sense. You know, the way to listen to a teisho or a koan is just to sit and watch your breath and listen, and sort of let your unconscious mind sort of process the information, you know. Because the language of the koan is like a language of a fairy story. It's right on the edge of, it's between consciousness and unconscious. It's between, you know, it's like, grandma, what big eyes you have, what a big nose you have, right? It's speaking to that part of your awareness. Guishan asked Yangshan, if somebody suddenly said all sentient beings have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk would come in, I would call him and say, hey you. If the monk turns his head, I would say, what is it? If he hesitates, I would say, not only is their active consciousness boundless and unclear, they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. So, you know, that probably makes very little sense. And if you want to buy this book, you can get it at Amazon. You know, it's called The Book of Serenity. And if you read the koan, it still won't make much sense. But if you sit with it for a while, if you're in samadhi and you sit with it, you know, the active consciousness, you know, this man is, he would call another monk, and the monk turns to hear. You know, what's that all about? If you sit with it, it begins to have like a psychodynamic effect, you could say. And little by little, something is going to come up. You know, when you're given a koan by the teacher, you know, even if you're working, it's not sesshin, you're working in your job, you know, on some level, you're always processing the koan, just a little bit. You'll notice sometime, when you sit down on the cushion, you realize the koan is there. You know, sometimes I've been working with koans, and I find myself, you know, when I was training, sometimes I would work with a koan for years. And sometimes when I would get close to the answer to the koan, I would find myself very edgy, you know, really pissed off, you know, without knowing why, sort of really edgy and raw. And then, you know, something would happen. My first teacher, Genki Roshi, when he would work with koans, he said, he was usually working with koans in the context of sesshin, and he said he would be struggling sitting with these koans, doing zazen, turning the koan over and over again. And he said then, you know, he would sometimes have a dream. And in his dream, he would see himself as a little boy. And he said, and then I would wake up and I would have the answer to my koan. Interesting, huh? Verse. One call and he turns his head. Do you know who you are or not? Do you know? What? Somebody calls and you turn your head. You don't think about it. It happens automatically, right? How does that happen? Do you know what you are or not? Did you know you were a whirlwind or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that. You know, we know ourselves only vaguely. You know, we get a little glimpse of who we really are only vaguely. It's like looking through ivy and seeing a crescent moon. You know, the child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destitution, has such sorrow. You know, humans are fundamentally this dynamic system, but we feel very boxed in all the time. We feel like we can't open up. We feel like we can't change. You know, we feel trapped. We feel, locked in, blocked. But fundamentally, we're this dynamic system. So it's a little bit like being rich but thinking you're poor all the time. You know, we're like people who are, the great Japanese Zen master Hakuin Zenji said, we're like somebody up to our head in water complaining about thirst. You know, it's even worse than that. We're like waves who are thirsty, right? We're like waves who feel thirsty. You know, fundamentally, we're all water. Openness is our fundamental nature. All you have to do is relax a little bit and you begin to experience it in the most delightful way.